This is Henry Simon, bringing you another story from my files here at the Missing Persons Bureau.
In these stories of the Missing Persons Bureau, dramatized for Henry Simon by Ross Napier, names and addresses have, for obvious reasons, been changed. In one moment, the search for the Reverend John Crane. Address unknown. And here again is Henry Simon.
He was a stranger to Renfrew, a quiet, dignified-looking man with dark hair silvering faintly at the temples. He'd been the only passenger to alight from the London train, and he was carrying a small overnight bag. It was raining in Renfrew at the time, so it was of no special significance that he was wearing his top coat buttoned up to the neck and his hat pulled well down on his forehead. At the station, he asked directions from the ticket collector, Bert Robbins.
Help you, sir?
Oh, indeed, yes. I wonder, could you direct me to the vicarage?
Vicarage, sir? Why, of course. You know Renfrew at all?
No, I've never been here before.
Oh, in that case, I'd suggest you take a cab. It's about a mile from here, and the bus only runs every 2 hours.
You do have a cab service, then?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it a service, sir. There's only the one. But I'll get you there, all right. That's it, over the way there. Belongs to George Smithers, the bootmaker's son. He'll be in the shop. Just give him a yell.
Oh, fine.
If you need a brolly, I got a spare in the office.
No, I'll manage. Many thanks for your help.
Not at all, sir. Only too glad to be of service.
Good morning. You'd be Mrs. Goodacre, of course.
Why, yes, but I don't believe
I... How do you do? I think you're expecting me.
Sir?
I'm John Crane, the new vicar.
You? Oh, dear. Oh, I'm ever so sorry, sir. Do come in.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, won't you, sir? But with your coat all done up like that, I never realized...
Quite understandable.
Then arriving like this so suddenly...
Oh, it's my place to apologize. I'm afraid I should have phoned from the station.
Oh, it's not that, sir. It's just that in your letter you said you wouldn't be here till tomorrow.
Well, I did intend stopping off at Burnley to visit one of my old parishioners. But at the last minute I changed my mind. I do hope it isn't going to inconvenience you.
No, sir. Everything's ready for you here. Only...
Yes?
Well, there was to be a reception committee to meet you at the station. Various members of the congregation. Oh, they'll be ever so disappointed they've missed you.
No more disappointed than I am at having missed them. But we'll iron all that out presently. For the moment, all I'm interested in is a hot bath and a change of clothing.
Oh, of course, sir. I'll run some water right away.
Oh, splendid. I take it my bag's arrived safely.
And yes, the day before yesterday, sir. They're upstairs in your room. I'll show you up.
Oh, very kind. I can see that we're going to get on well together.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'll do my best to see you comfortable here.
I'm sure you will, Mrs. Goodacre. Or shall I call you Emily?
Oh, sir. Oh, I'd be very proud if you would.
Emily it is, then.
Oh, you'll be wanting something to eat as well, I expect.
Not for an hour or two. I had tea and cakes on the train. The main thing is not to fuss. Once I'm organized, I'm a man who needs very little looking after. Very little indeed.
And so the Reverend John Crane arrived to take over his duties as vicar in the Shropshire village of Renfrew. A man of boundless enthusiasm and seemingly infinite goodwill, he readily won the respect and the love of his parishioners. And in a few very short months, he'd trebled his congregation. There were many who came from neighbouring villages to hear him preach on Sundays, and more than a few regarded him as a prophet of hope and salvation. But of all these, there was none more ardent in her admiration of the new vicar than his own housekeeper, Emily Goodacre. To her, he reigned supreme among men, as sympathetic as he was generous, and as hard-working as he was kind.
Come in.
Oh, I'm off to bed, sir. Your milk's in the thermos. Is there anything else you'd be needing?
Thank you, Emily. Not tonight. You run along. I'll see you in the morning.
It's after 11. Isn't it time you were turning in yourself?
I'll be off presently.
Yes, that's what you always say, sir. But I'll warrant it's not often you're in bed before 3 in the morning. And not that it's my place to speak, but don't you think you're overdoing it?
Oh, there's so much to be done, Emily.
Yes, that may be, sir. There's no sense in driving yourself into the ground. You've your health to think of. And if you won't give a thought to yourself, well, think of all those who come to depend on you, who'd be lost without you to guide them, myself included.
Oh, come now.
Oh, it's the truth, sir. We need you here in Renfrew.
You speak as if I were going away.
You'll be going away right enough if you don't rest up a bit to hospital.
Perhaps you're right. Still, it won't be for much longer. The end is very definitely in sight.
The end, sir?
My plans for the erecting of a new church hall. I've been in touch with the builders and they're ready to commence work.
Oh, but that's wonderful news, sir. When do they start?
Just as soon as I've raised the money to pay them.
Oh, with all those functions you've been holding, I wonder you haven't already done that.
We're still a few hundred short.
Well, next Saturday's fate should help.
It may even do the trick. Yes, with any luck, I'll be able to make the official announcement in church on Sunday.
Oh, sir, and to think they said you'd take 10 years to do it. Why, it'll be less than 10 months.
A little hard work and a great deal of faith. That's the recipe, my dear Emily. The one and only recipe for success.
The church fete that was held on the following Saturday afternoon in aid of the building fund for the new church hall more than fulfilled the vicar's hopes. From a financial viewpoint, it exceeded anything of its kind that had ever before been held in the district, and it raised the sum of £1,300, thus bringing the total of the fund itself to £7,624.18, which was some £300 in excess of the amount which was required for the building of the church hall. This fact was not announced in church the following Sunday morning, however, for the very good reason that the vicar was not in church to announce it. He wasn't at the vicarage either, or anywhere else in Renfrew. The truth of the matter was, he disappeared, and the money had gone with him. For us at the Missing Persons Bureau, this story had its beginning from 3 days later, when I was visited here in my office by Mrs. Emily Goodacre, the vicar's housekeeper, who told me the story which I've just been telling you, and then went on to add that, although her own faith was quite unshaken by Crane's mysterious departure, there were others of his congregation who would be very quick to draw conclusions which were contrary to her own, especially when they discovered the amount of money which was involved.
I know them too well, Mr. Simon. When they learn the truth, they'll say he's stolen the money, that he's run off with it.
Isn't that exactly what he has done?
No. He's gone away. I don't know why or where, but I do know that he'll be back and the money with him.
You're quite sure the money's gone?
I'm not sure of anything. All I know is that he kept it in the safe in his office and it's not there now.
He kept £7,000 in his office?
Yes, I was the only one who knew about it. He said it was the best place, that he didn't want to risk letting it out of his hands.
How was it he took you into his confidence and nobody else?
Well, one evening when I thought he was in bed, I walked into his office without knocking. Caught him unawares, like. The safe was open and there were bundles of notes on his desk.
Yes?
Well, he said he was checking the amount in hand.
I see. And that's how you found out?
Yes.
Did he give you access to the safe as well?
Oh, no, I never even saw the key.
Well, how'd you know the money'd gone?
Oh, well, because when I went in to look for him on Sunday morning, I found it unlocked. He must have been in a hurry when he closed it. A handle was thrown too, but it wasn't locked.
So you opened it?
Only when I discovered he wasn't in the house.
When did you discover that?
When I went to his room a few minutes later. His bed hadn't been slept in, and his bag and some of his clothes were missing.
I see. Well, then, apart from yourself, does anybody else know of his disappearance?
No.
Weren't certain inquiries made and he didn't appear in church to conduct the service?
Oh, yes, but I told everyone he'd been called away suddenly to London, that he'd taken the first train that morning.
I presume you realize that for so doing, if he has taken the money, you could be named as an accomplice.
Yes, and I'm prepared to take that risk.
You must think very highly of him.
Oh, I do. And regardless of what anyone might say or think about him, I always will. He's the finest man I've ever known.
When was the last time you saw him?
Shortly after 10:30 on the Saturday evening, when I took him in his milk.
How did he seem then?
Well, he was much the same. A little more tired-looking than usual. Well, but I'd put that down to the fact that he'd had a big day.
I see. At what time on the Sunday morning did you discover that he was missing?
Somewhere between 8:30 and 9:30.
And that was also when you found the safe was unlocked?
Yes.
So he must have left the house at some time between 10:30 the previous evening and 9:00 that morning?
Yes.
Did he happen to own a car?
No.
I see. So that means that if he was leaving town, he'd have had to go by train. Assuming, of course, he wasn't picked up.
Yes.
Can you think of any other reason he might have had, apart from the obvious one, for going away so very abruptly?
No, but something must have come up. Something unexpected.
Such as?
Oh, I don't know, but look, there must be some explanation.
Much as I hate to condemn a man on circumstantial evidence alone, there's only one that I can think of, and that, of course, is the money.
You'd feel differently if you'd known him.
But surely if something had come up, he'd have notified you. He wouldn't simply have left without any word of explanation. Especially as he was expected in church on the following morning.
Yes, it does seem strange, I know, but... Well, if I wasn't so sure of him, I wouldn't be here.
He's been in Renfrew for less than a year, I think you said?
About 9 months.
Was that his first appointment?
Oh, no, he was at Ransfield for quite a time, and before that at Epping.
Ransfield. Mm-hmm. That's somewhere in Kent, isn't it?
Yes, not far from Dover.
How old would he be, approximately?
It'd be hard to say. In his early 40s, perhaps.
You don't happen to have a photograph of him, by any chance?
No, I'm real sorry. I can only give you a description.
Has he no family?
No, he was married, but his wife died some years ago.
No children?
He never mentioned any.
Well, just one more thing. If you're so certain he's going to come back of his own accord, what prompted you to come along to me?
Well, he's been gone 3 days. I had to do something.
In case any awkward questions are asked, eh?
Yes, if he doesn't show up soon, questions are bound to be asked.
Such as the nature of his business in London.
That and other things. He has to be found before it gets out about the money. Once that happens, there's no telling where it might end.
Henry Simon returns to continue this story in just a moment. And here again is Henry Simon.
If there was a single unique aspect in the case of the missing vicar, it was Emily Goodacre's faith in the man himself, her refusal to believe that he could be party to a wrongful or dishonest deed. Whether or not that faith was entirely justified, however, was altogether another question. I briefed Agent Bob Hunter for this assignment. He, in turn, lost very little time in moving into action. And on that same afternoon, he set the ball in motion by journeying down to Ransfield, our quarry's former parish. There, he sought out and questioned the Reverend Philip Davidson, Crane's successor, who claimed to be a very old friend of the missing man's.
We were at Cambridge together. We saw quite a lot of each other. I was a great admirer of John in those days. Fine athlete. Not only won his blue at cricket, but rode with the eights. Played a first-rate game of tennis, too, I remember.
Something of an all-rounder, huh?
Yeah, he was that right enough. And a brilliant scholar to boot.
Well, how do you rate as a person?
I beg your pardon?
What kind of a guy was he?
Oh, they didn't come much better. A more generous fellow you couldn't hope to meet.
How was he with money?
Money? Yeah. I don't quite follow.
Well, we'll skip that for the moment. Did your association end when you left Cambridge?
Oh, no. We continued to correspond for quite some time. I moved up to Leicester, and he went to Durham, and later to Epping. Occasionally, when we both happened to be in London, we'd get together, but that wasn't often.
I see. Mostly it was a matter of correspondence.
Yes.
Well, how long did this go on?
Oh, 5 years or so.
And then you lost touch?
More or less, yes. Oh, you know how these things are. He was married by then, of course. His responsibilities had increased considerably.
His wife died, I believe.
When he was here at Rainsford, yes. Most unfortunate. Nasty blow to him. Understand, he developed some sort of heart trouble soon after. His doctor advised a change of climate, so he applied for a transfer.
Which resulted in his going to Renfrew and you're taken over here.
That's right, yes. Although I didn't succeed him immediately.
Huh?
There was a Reverend Alexander here for a brief period. He acted more or less as a stopgap till I came.
Yeah.
John had actually been gone for some 2 months when I arrived. Oh, that's his photograph above the mantel, by the way. Taken by one of the parishioners shortly before he left. I was requested by several members of the congregation to hang it here as a tribute to his popularity.
Wait a minute. Something's wrong somewhere.
Wrong?
Yeah, the description I have, it doesn't quite tally. According to it, he has straight dark hair graying at the temples. Well, in that photo, it's fair and curly.
Dark hair?
Yeah.
John? Oh, there must be some mistake. His whole coloring was very fair.
Maybe you'd better check these other details.
Well, let's have a look.
Well?
Height and weight appear to be in order. As for the rest... Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Hunter, but I'm afraid you have the wrong man.
This was perhaps the one possibility we hadn't taken into consideration, that the man who for 9 whole months had been known as the Vicar of Renfrew was not in fact the Reverend John Crane, but an impostor of unknown identity. Back in London, Hunter immediately contacted our client, who was spending the night at a West End hotel with the intention of returning to Renfrew first thing the following morning. He showed a photograph of John Crane, which he had borrowed from the Reverend Davidson.
Take a good solid look, Mrs. Goodacre. Is this the man you knew as the Reverend Crane?
Wait till I... Oh, why, no, it's nothing like him.
Well, in that case, I'm sorry to tell you, ma'am, that you've been hooked.
Hooked?
Together with every other member of the congregation.
But I don't understand.
The guy you knew as the vicar was a phony, fake. His name wasn't Crane, and he wasn't a clergyman. In fact, I wouldn't mind betting that before coming to Renfrew, he'd never been to church in his life.
Now, Mrs. Goodacre, I want you to listen very carefully indeed to what I'm going to say. I know perfectly well all this has been a very great shock to you, and I realize that you're most upset. But you must appreciate the fact that you've been placed in an extremely awkward position.
I just can't understand it, Mr. Simon. He seems so good and kind, so understanding.
Yes, unfortunately, most competent tricksters have a knack of seeming to be what they're not. And this man would appear to be an exceedingly clever competent trickster. Which, of course, is why we shall need all our wits about us, if we're going to catch him.
I still won't believe that he stole that money. Nothing will ever make me believe that.
You see what I mean, Chief? She just won't be told.
In that case, I'm afraid we have no alternative. You better phone Scotland Yard.
Oh, no, please, no, not that. Look, I'll do anything you ask. Anything, but don't call the police.
2 men have disappeared, Mrs. Goodacre. One of them has run off with over £7,000, which doesn't belong to him. And the other's been missing for almost a year. He could be anywhere. For that matter, he could be dead. We've no way at all of knowing until we find the man who took his place. And only you can help us do that.
But I don't see how I
can. And I'll tell you. For the past 9 months, you've been his housekeeper. You've been living under the very same roof. In the course of that time, you must have noticed certain odd things about him. Things that didn't altogether tie in with the facts as you knew them. Now, did he spend much time out of Renfrew?
He went away for a few days every so often.
Try to be more precise. How often?
Well, once a month, perhaps.
And to where did he go?
To visit a friend, he said.
What friend?
I don't know. Unless it was that Mrs. Rutledge.
Mrs. Rutledge?
Yes, she called to see him once at the vicarage. I think he said she was a former parishioner of his.
Oh? When was this?
About 2 months ago. He took her into his office. They were there for some hours, and then she left. I wouldn't have thought anything of it, only...
Yes?
Well, I heard them laughing together, and then they locked the door. I was dusting the hall. I couldn't help hearing the key turn in the lock. Not that I paid much attention to it at the time, but, well, it did set me wondering. Oh, well, I mean to say, it didn't seem exactly proper somehow.
Did you ever see this woman again?
No. But I recognized her voice on the phone more than once. It's a part of my job to answer the phone.
Did she ring him often?
3 or 4 times that I can remember.
Do you happen to know if he ever rang her?
No, but he did write to her once.
Oh?
Yes, I saw the letter on his desk, or rather a sealed envelope addressed to her. He hadn't got round to posting it.
You didn't happen to recall the address, I suppose?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. I'm not ashamed to admit that I was curious, and perhaps I was even a little bit jealous. Not in the usual way, but, well, I thought so highly of him. And...
Yes, I quite understand. Now, the address. What was it?
Mrs. Diane Rutledge, Hobart Mansions, Lord Street, Bristol. Yes.
Hunter boarded the first available train for Bristol, arriving in that city shortly before 10:30 in the evening. Outside the station, he hailed a cab, instructing the driver to take him to Hobart Mansions in Lord Street, a 6th-floor block of luxury flats overlooking Garfield Park. From the indicator in the foyer, the agent ascertained that the lady in question occupied flat number 12 on the fourth floor.
It's a little late for callers, Sonny boy, but don't let that bother you. You just keep pressing that buzzer till it drops off.
Mrs. Rutledge?
The aunt tradesman.
Clergyman, too?
You've got the wrong number, Sonny. Enough the religious type.
Neither's your boyfriend, the vicar. Where is he, by the way?
Vicar? You're not serious.
Not half as serious as the cops will be when they get here. You're in big trouble, beautiful, and I don't mean maybe. Now, where is he?
If you're referring to Clive Regan, I haven't the foggiest notion. He's no friend of mine. I had nothing to do with it.
What?
With whatever he's mixed up in.
Okay. Well, you just drape that lovely form of yours in some street clothes and let's go spread the glad tidings, huh?
I'm not leaving here.
Have it your own way. You don't mind if I borrow your phone? I didn't think you would. Hello? Operator, this is an emergency. Get me the police.
It was immediately obvious to Hunter that under pressure, Diane Rutledge would be very quick to tell all that she knew. The agent was in no position to exert that pressure, however, so he called for the police to exert it for him. As he'd expected, they made very short work of the job, and they soon had the whole astonishing story. The Reverend John Crane was dead. He had, it appeared, died of a very sudden heart attack in the train en route from Bransfield to Burnley, where he'd planned to spend a few days with a friend before taking up his pastoral duties at Renfrew. It just so happened that a very few minutes before his death, he'd entered into a conversation with a fellow traveller named Clive Regan. It was late at night. The two were alone in the compartment. Crane had fainted, and Regan, believing him to be asleep, had attempted to relieve him of his wallet and sundry other items of value. He was just in the act of doing this when he discovered that the clergyman was dead, a fact that presented to his mind the opportunity of a lifetime. Undismayed, he calmly pushed the body out of the train window, alighted himself at the next station, and then returned to the spot where it had fallen. He then switched clothes with the clergyman, and having already taken possession of the overnight bag belonging to the dead man, he dragged the body to a ditch and left it there, to be discovered a day or two later, but never claimed or identified. Meanwhile, Regan had arrived in Renfrew, and having briefed himself thoroughly on his new identity from various letters and private papers which he'd found in Crane's possession, he had assumed the role of vicar. His triumph, however, was short-lived, as his honey-blonde girlfriend also told the police where to find him, and in less than an hour, he was picked up and taken to a police cell, a very far cry from the residence which he'd enjoyed during his brief term as the vicar of Renfrew.
I don't know, Chief. What gets me is how you had the gall to think he could get away with it.
Yeah, I might remind you, Hunter, that he very nearly did. And most certainly would have done so if he hadn't lavished just a little too much charm on his housekeeper.
Yeah, true enough, I guess. He could have been caught out in any one of a thousand ways.
Fact remains that he wasn't. But perhaps being the kind of man he is, he enjoyed the risk involved. Besides, he was already wanted by the police, you know. As it is, he'll just get a few extra years tacked onto his sentence and a slightly larger spread in the newspapers. Not a great deal more, much as he deserves it.
Yeah. You know, I sure feel sorry for Mrs. Goodacre, though, for old dame.
And all the others he hoodwinked. So I dare say time will repair the damage that's been done. Usually does. Oh, talking of time reminds me, I've got another client waiting in the next office.
Yeah.
On your way out, tell Pauline to send her in, will you?
Henry Simon returns to conclude this story in just a moment. And here again is Henry Simon.
Little remains for me to say in regard to this case, except to record the fact that at his ensuing trial, Clive Regan was sentenced to 8 years' imprisonment. As for Diane Rutledge, well, she was slightly more fortunate, and chiefly due to her cooperation with the police, she was let off on a 2-year bond. Of the stolen money, a little under £5,000 was recovered, the remainder having been spent by Regan during his term of office. Whether this will be reclaimed by the parishioners concerned or used, as was originally intended by them, to provide a new church hall, of course, I couldn't say. But in either case, it's going to be a very long time indeed before any of them forget the man who induced it from their pockets in the first place. Clive Regan, alias John Crane, alias the Vicar of Renfrew. And now, this is Henry Simon inviting you, as always, to meet me here again. And, for the present, bidding you au revoir.